Hi gang, it's a new week and that means a new episode. So welcome back. This week we've got shoutouts for two new patrons. I want to thank Haley and Jasmine who both signed up this week to help support the show. I hope you guys are loving the extra content and your sticker and card is in the mail. Now on to today's episode. In 1955, United Airlines Flight 629 exploded midair and plummeted into a beet field in Longmont, Colorado, killing all 44 people on board. News reported it as a terrible accident, but as police further investigated, they realized this was something way more complicated than they could have ever imagined. No, it was not an accident. It was not a terrorist attack. It was not a murder-suicide. The bombing of Flight 629 uncovered a story of hatred, envy, and grudges that stemmed back from the 1930s. This is the story of the American mass murderer, Jack Gilbert Graham. John Gilbert Graham, known simply as Jack, was born January 23, 1932, in Denver, Colorado, to parents Daisy and William Graham. His mother had been previously married and divorced, and through that marriage had a daughter, Helen. Helen's father wasn't in the picture, so when Daisy married William Graham, she was looking for someone to provide for her and her daughter. When Jack was born in 1932, it was the height of the Great Depression, and Daisy and William were having a really hard time supporting their two children. In order to feed the kids, the family moved around America, chasing mining jobs for William, who was an engineer. For a while, this provided enough for the four of them to eat and get by. But then things took a turn for the worse. William got very sick with pneumonia and died from the infection in 1935. Now Daisy was left to raise her 12-year-old daughter and 3-year-old son alone. After her husband's death, Daisy got a job at a phone company to get by. Her mother offered to watch the children while she worked. However, her mother too soon got too sick to care for the children, and everything came crumbling down. Daisy was relieved when some of her relatives offered to take in Helen as a preteen. But nobody wanted to take in a toddler. After Helen was sent to live with relatives, Daisy felt that she had no choice but to place Jack in an orphanage, hoping he would get better care there. Looking back, Helen says her mother was never very maternal. She insisted that the kids call her Daisy and not Mom, which of course doesn't mean you're a bad mother, you have the right to be called whatever you want, but Daisy wasn't really the kind of mom to tuck you in with a bedtime story. So when Jack was 5 or 6, he was sent to the Clayton College of Denver, an orphanage for young, white males who had either lost both parents or their father. It was a place for boys to have a father figure if they didn't have one at home. The orphanage's mission was to prepare these kids in the trades, such as farming, building, or other kinds of manual work. So the kids were forced into this kind of work from the morning, and then they would attend academic classes in the afternoon. Doesn't exactly sound like fun for a young kid. And Jack didn't think so either. He hated the orphanage, especially being away from his mom and sister. He apparently attempted to run away several times, trying to go back to his mother's house, but each time he was returned. Then in 1941, Daisy met and married her third husband, Earl King. Earl was a wealthy rancher, and this marriage provided Daisy with some financial security. Though, despite this newfound wealth, Daisy did not go pick up her son from the orphanage. The Denver Post reported that Daisy one time brought Jack home for Christmas and gifted him a pony. But after the holidays, against his wishes, Jack was sent back to the orphanage. And obviously his pony stayed at the ranch. So it shows that if she's buying ponies, she could obviously afford to have her son come live with her. But instead, she bought this horse, which was basically for herself, because it's not like Jack took it with him. It's said that Jack's grudge against his mother stemmed from this decision, that even though she had the ability to do so, she didn't bring him home. Some newspapers say that Jack did spend some time with his relatives as a preteen, but every time he lived with his relatives for a period of time, he would end up back at the orphanage. So these living situations didn't work out for whatever reason. In April of 1948, when Jack was 16, he was desperate to get out of the orphanage and forged identification papers in order to join the Coast Guard. However, after only a few months of being in the Navy, it was discovered that he was underage, and he was discharged in January of 1949. It's also noted that there were several days during these months in the Navy that Jack just wouldn't show up for service. So I don't think he was interested in joining the Coast Guard at all. I think it was just an excuse to get out of the orphanage or away from his relatives' house. After he was discharged from the Army, and now that he was old enough to kind of take care of himself, his mother and stepfather allowed him to come live with them on their ranch. However, Jack quickly learned that he and his mother didn't get along, and he decided to go live with his uncle instead. As an older teen, Jack got a job in payroll at a local factory and took this as an opportunity to start stealing and forging checks. After stealing over $4,000, which is almost $45,000 in today's money, he was caught. So he fled Denver and started selling whiskey in Texas to get by. However, 2 months after arriving in Texas, he was arrested for bootlegging and spent 60 days in jail. He was then returned to Denver in 1951 to face the charges of forgery and robbery. Luckily for him, his mother Daisy helped him out. She was friends with the sheriff, who requested the judge be lenient on the young man. Daisy also paid off half of her son's debt. The judge gave him 5 years probation on the understanding that he would pay off the remainder of what he owed. Now that he needed to find a real job to pay all this money back, Jack enrolled in the University of Denver to take business administration. It was there that he met his wife Gloria, who was taking secretarial studies. Gloria seemed to bring out the best in Jack. Jack's probation officer said that he was a model probationer and was never late with his restitution checks. Jack switched around various jobs, such as working at an insurance firm or a mechanic garage, but it seemed like he was getting on a right path. In June 1953, Jack and Gloria married and shortly after had their first son, Alan. Then in 1954, Daisy again became a widow when her husband, Earl King, passed away. She decided it was the perfect time to reach out to her son and daughter-in-law. Some say to repair the relationship. Daisy offered Jack and Gloria a deal. If they would move back to Denver and be closer to her, she would buy them a house. At this time, Daisy owned a successful drive-in diner called Crown A Drive-In, and she suggested that Jack could maybe manage the restaurant for her as a means of income. Daisy was also swimming in inheritance at this point. Not only had she gotten her husband's ranch and money when he passed, but she had also recently benefited off her dad's inheritance, who too had just passed away. By fall of 1954, Jack and Gloria were expecting their second child and agreed that a free house would be nice. So they moved home and Jack began running the diner. But now, spending more time with his mother brought back feelings of abandonment and resentment. Jack was running the business while Daisy would go on vacation to Florida. Since she was the owner, though, she was still bringing in the cash. So I think that was another reason as to why Jack resented his mother. He did the work, she collected. Jack's wife Gloria would later say that she thought her husband and mother-in-law got along just fine. Yeah, they had little spats now and then, but nothing serious. But deep down, Jack's hatred for his mother was boiling up, and he was about to explode. In February of 1955, Jack and Gloria had their second child, a daughter named Suzanne. Complications with the birth and an emergency C-section meant that Gloria couldn't care for her children for a while. Recovering from surgery would have taken some time back in the 50s. This meant that Daisy had stepped up to care for the children. But this also meant that Daisy was around a lot. She now actually had her own room in the house. And remember, she paid for this house, so Jack couldn't exactly kick her out. Jack couldn't stand his mother being around. He couldn't stand to see Daisy raising his children when she didn't bother to raise him. A few months into running the diner, the business wasn't doing too well. I mean, it's hard to build a business from the ground up. They weren't bankrupt, but they weren't exactly making profit from it. And Daisy had apparently blamed Jack because he was the one running it. Daisy suggested selling the diner at one point, but that meant Jack would be out of a job with no money. Then in the early morning hours of Monday, September 5th, 1955, the Crown A drive-in was destroyed by a small explosion caused by a gas leak. When police investigated, they said it appeared that a fitting on the main gas line had been unscrewed, and arson was highly suspected. However, nothing could be proven and no charges were filed. As a result of the explosion, Jack collected $1,200 from insurance that he had just bought for the diner and put in his name. Again, it's never been proven what caused the fire, but it's highly suspected that Jack was responsible. Fortunately, this time, nobody was hurt. But it would later become clear that Jack didn't care too much about other human lives anyway. Let's take a moment to hear from a quick ad break. Okay, we're back. On November 1st, 1955, Daisy had plans to go visit her daughter Helen and her children, who lived in Alaska. She was going for Thanksgiving and didn't plan to return until after Christmas. Flight 629 was scheduled to depart at 6:30 p.m. and stop in Portland, Oregon. The plane would then travel on to its final destination, Seattle, Washington, where Daisy would have to switch planes. At 4:30 p.m. that day, Jack woke up from an afternoon nap. Since the explosion at the diner, he had started working as a mechanic, often working night shifts. But that day, he offered to drive his mother to the airport. He told her that he had a Christmas present for her, and that he would pack it in her bag, but she couldn't open it until later. It was a surprise. When Jack opened his mother's suitcase, it was way too full. So he took out a bathrobe, a bag full of wedding photos that Daisy had planned to show Helen, and two antique flasks. Now that there was more room, Jack put in the special present he had planned for his mother. But it wasn't a Christmas gift. It was 25 sticks of dynamite, with two blasting caps, a timer, and a 6-volt battery. A single stick of dynamite would have been enough to destroy a plane. Jack packed 25. At 5 p.m., Jack, his wife Gloria, and their 1.5-year-old son Alan drove Daisy out to Denver's Stapleton Airport. Traffic was bad, and they didn't arrive until 6 p.m. Remember, the flight was at 6:30. But also keep in mind, in the 50s, you didn't have to go through security or anything like that. So you didn't need to show up at the airport 3 hours in advance. While it obviously wasn't suggested that you roll up 30 minutes beforehand, it was likely that Daisy was still going to make her flight. Jack then offered to park the car as the woman and the baby went inside. When Jack pulled into the parking lot, he opened up the suitcase to make sure his surprise present was ready. He then set the 1-hour timer, scheduling the bomb to detonate at 7 p.m., 30 minutes into the flight. They headed to the terminal where Daisy could drop off her bags. When Jack lifted the bags onto the scale, the ticket agent informed Daisy that her bag was 37 pounds overweight. I mean, I imagine that bomb was pretty heavy. She was informed that she would have to pay a $28 fee, which is almost $250 now, so an absolutely ridiculous amount. The agent told Daisy that it might be better if she mailed some of her things separately. It would be cheaper that way. But Jack encouraged his mother to pay the extra fee. Quote, "You better take it all, mother. You'll need it," end quote. Plus, she didn't exactly have time to go sort through what to bring and what to mail. She was in a bit of a hurry. So she followed her son's instructions and just paid the fee. Though, let's just take a minute to think about how Jack was feeling when the agent suggested opening the suitcase and taking some things out. He was probably about to poop his pants. After the luggage was dropped off at the desk, Jack encouraged his mother to buy life insurance. Back then, you could actually buy life insurance right in the airport at a kiosk. All you had to do was insert the quarters and a policy would print for you. This was a pretty popular thing to do, as a lot of people were unsure about the safety of flights back then. Jack knew his mother had a fear of flying and probably used this to encourage her to get life insurance. At the kiosk, Jack purchased 3 life insurance policies. 2 for $6,250, with the beneficiaries being Helen, Daisy's daughter, and the other Daisy's sister. Then he bought a larger one of $37,500, equivalent to over $350,000 today, and listed himself as the beneficiary. Daisy did sign these, so she knew about them, but FBI was later able to prove by handwriting samples that Jack had filled out the forms, which to me kind of shows that Jack was the one who pushed for the life insurance policies. After Daisy signed the forms, the kiosk gave them a copy of each of the forms. One copy was for the person to keep, and the other copy was to put in this slot in the kiosk, because if the plane did go down, there would need to be a safe copy for these policies that wasn't going to be destroyed. However, Jack inserted the 2 copies of the smaller policies into the kiosk, but never gave the kiosk the copy of the one for $37,500. And I'll come back to this later to explain why he might have done this. Then the family waited at Daisy's gate. They were informed that the plane was late. It was coming from New York and then going to make a stop in Denver. But it had been delayed in New York and therefore would not be departing at 6:30 p.m. However, the timer on the bomb had been set to detonate at 7 p.m. So I imagine Jack was sweating pretty hard, hoping the plane would take off in time. Shortly after, though, Daisy boarded United Airlines Flight 629. The plane took off at 6:52 p.m., 22 minutes late. But luckily for Jack, in time for his plan. As Jack watched his mother board the plane, he realized this would be the last time he would ever see her. Quote, "I felt happier than I had ever felt in my life," Jack would later recall. After Daisy had boarded the plane, Jack, Gloria, and toddler Alan went to a coffee shop in the airport to get some dinner. Midway through dinner, Jack excused himself and ran to the washroom and vomited. He came back to the table minutes later and told his wife that he felt much better. Is it possible that his vomiting was caused by feeling remorseful? Meanwhile on the aircraft, the pilot turned on the seatbelt sign and sent a message to the control tower that takeoff had been successful. At 6:56, they sent their last communication. Then, at 7:03 p.m., while over Longmont, Colorado, the plane burst into a ball of fire and plummeted 5,800 feet towards the ground. Men in the control towers remembered seeing a flash of light in the sky, way off into the distance. They later reported it looked like a flare from a plane in distress. It wasn't. It was the plane exploding, but from so far away they couldn't tell. The men immediately contacted all the planes in the sky, asking for an all-good signal. All planes returned the signal, except one, Flight 629. The plane exploded in the sky, sending debris flying through the air and landing across a 5-mile radius on a Colorado beet farm. Many residents came out of their houses to see what the noise was. Because the plane was 22 minutes behind schedule, it didn't explode where Jack had planned. He had timed it so that the plane would explode over the Rocky Mountains, making it harder to collect the debris or maybe trying to make investigators think that the plane had crashed into the mountains by accident. In fact, just a month before this crash, another United Airlines flight had crashed into the Medicine Bow Mountains, and everyone on board was killed. The scene of the accident was not easily accessible down in the mountains, and it was difficult to investigate the crash. The cause of this crash has never been determined, but it's assumed to have been an accident caused by bad weather. But this is where Jack got the inspiration for detonating the bomb over the Rocky Mountains. However, since the flight was delayed, the plane had only been in the air for 11 minutes, and that's why it exploded over the farm field. The Longmont police and firefighters were on the scene almost immediately, as many had called in to report what they had just seen. The Longmont police chief radioed the Colorado State Police to ask for assistance. State police replied and asked if they needed an ambulance at the scene. Longmont police chief replied, "No, there was no need for ambulances." It was clear that nobody had survived this crash. All 44 people on board were killed, 39 passengers and 5 crew. Back at the airport, as Jack and Gloria were enjoying a meal in the cafe, rumors of a plane crash spread around the airport. Jack and Gloria asked for details, but nobody in the airport knew anything yet. All they knew was that a United Airlines plane hadn't returned their radio signals, and police were being sent to the scene of a plane crash. Jack and Gloria decided that they would hurry home so then they could listen on the radio about what had happened. When they got home, Jack called the airport and asked for an update, as the radio still didn't know the situation. The United Airlines rep on the phone confirmed that Flight 629 had crashed, and that all passengers on board were presumed dead. Jack replied, quote, "Well, that's the way it goes," end quote. Back at the scene, police investigators searched for bodies. It said some were still strapped into their seats. The Rocky Mountain News described the night as, quote, "a scene of death and horror under flickering flames," end quote. At 7 a.m. the next morning, investigators have recovered almost all of the bodies. Daisy King was sent to the morgue, labeled as body number 38. All bodies were later accounted for and identified, some through fingerprints, some by family and friends. As I said, all 44 people had died, 39 passengers and 5 crew. That included the pilot Lee Hall, a 38-year-old married father of 4, and World War II veteran. Co-pilot, 26-year-old Don White, recently married with 2 young kids. The flight engineer, 38-year-old Sam Arthur, also married with 2 kids. And 2 stewardesses, Peggy Petticord and Jacqueline Hines, aged 22 and 26. Among the 39 passengers was 20-year-old Sally Schofield, whose wedding would have been in 3 weeks. She also just happened to be a friend of Gloria Graham. Then there was Brad and Carol Bynum, who were expecting their first child together. Brad had also served at D-Day. Another passenger was Helen Fitzpatrick and her son, 1-year-old James Fitzpatrick, who were flying to Japan so James could meet his father for the first time, as he had been away in the Navy. To find out what caused the crash, each piece of debris was collected and brought to an airport hangar, where investigators made a reconstruction of the crash site. Because the wreckage was spread out over a 5-square-mile radius, it was theorized that the plane had exploded in the sky, and not upon impact with the ground. This also matched with witness statements of those who saw the plane go down. So they knew something had happened in the sky. Then, investigators studying the plane noticed that near the back of the plane, almost at the tail, the metal had been ripped from the inside out, which meant that an explosion had occurred. They now knew that the explosion had gone from the back of the plane, but they needed to find the origin of the explosion. They moved on to studying the cargo and could tell by the damage that the explosion, more specifically, came from the 4th cargo room. There were 4 cargo rooms on the plane, where luggage was stored. But the thing about cargo 4 was that only people who had boarded the plane in Denver had their luggage in that compartment. because, as I mentioned earlier, the plane had already had people on it from New York. So now detectives theorize that there must have been a volatile substance in someone's bag that exploded under pressure. Back then, bags were not searched and people didn't go through security. I mean, hell, you could smoke on planes if you wanted to. It could have been anything. But as they went through the rubble and began to reconstruct Cargo 4, they smelt something. Investigators noticed that the debris and pieces of plane from Cargo 4 smelt like firecrackers, is how they later described it. An FBI forensic chemist came in and said he believed it was the smell of dynamite. On day 6 or 7 of the investigation, investigators realized that this was not the result of a terrible accident, like they had first thought. This plane had been purposely bombed. This was practically unheard of. Purposely bombing a passenger plane? This had never happened in the United States before. The idea that the explosion was intentional, it didn't even cross investigators' minds. Right away, the main theory was that it was a disgruntled employee who had planted the bomb. At the time, the unions had been striking and a lot of people were angry with the airlines, so maybe this was a way for a former employee to get even with United Airlines. On November 10th, United Airlines announced a $25,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of the individual responsible. In the meantime, while still being suspicious of the union, police began looking into the background of every passenger. FBI agents went around the country, talking to relatives of the victims, co-workers of the victims. Were any of these victims suicidal? Were any having affairs? Anyone that someone wanted to get revenge on? But it seemed like none of these people had enemies. There were no criminal records of the victims, or if so, no serious ones. So if revenge or love wasn't the motive, police turned to the last motive in the book. Money. Who would have benefited from this plane crashing? That's when they began looking into passengers who had life insurance policies. Many people had life insurance policies. As I said, plane travel wasn't seen as super safe back then, so it was pretty common to buy these. As they looked through the insurance policies, nothing appeared startling. According to the kiosk, a passenger named Daisy King had purchased two insurance policies that were both worth $6,250. Because remember, I told you that Jack had hidden the third policy. The insurance company hadn't processed the policy yet, meaning the only way to tell which policies had been purchased was through the copies in the airport kiosk. And since Jack only deposited the copies of the two smaller policies, that's all the machine knew so far. He knew that eventually the policy would be processed by the company, but it would take some time. He must have suspected that investigators would turn to the kiosk copies to see who had bought insurance. And that's why he hid the copy. He didn't want them to know that he had taken out that much money on his mother. Anyway, so the insurance policies weren't too alarming. But they did notice that Daisy King was the only passenger who both had insurance policies and who had boarded on Denver, because they knew the bomb had boarded the plane in Denver. So now, investigators zeroed in on Daisy King. They went to interview both of Daisy's kids, Jack and Helen, who had flown in to help with Daisy's funeral. As detectives asked the two questions about their mother, they learned about the diner that Daisy and Jack had run together. They also learned that Daisy's $150,000 estate would go to her children upon her death. Detectives then asked the two if anyone helped Daisy pack. And Jack said that his mother was very private about her packing and would never let anyone help her. He, of course, didn't mention that he had packed a surprise Christmas gift. When asked about the life insurance policies, Jack told them that his mother had purchased three of them. This caught the detective's attention because they'd only found the two in the kiosk. Jack then said he had mistakenly thrown the third copy into the trash instead of into the kiosk slot, and that's why there were only two copies there. But he assured the detectives that the policies weren't very much. Maybe about $12,000, he guessed. Detectives later recalled that Jack was very confident in these interviews. He even answered questions that he wasn't even asked. Then he gave detectives a description of his mother's luggage, so that they could look for it amongst the rubble. The detectives thanked the two and left. After the interview, investigators were told that Daisy King's purse had been found near her body. Inside her purse was a checkbook, an address list, a receipt for a safety deposit box, and some newspaper clippings about her family. Some of the newspaper clippings were about Jack's bad boy days, when he had gotten arrested for forgery checks. Also about the diner explosion and the insurance claim for that. Why she had these in her purse, I have no idea. But it gave investigators the clues they needed to look further into Jack. So this time, FBI officers asked Gloria Graham if she would come in to chat, which she did. As she spoke to the officer, Gloria corroborated her husband's account of what happened that day. She, of course, had no idea that her husband was a suspect. She thought this was just a casual interview. However, she mentioned something Jack never did. She told them that Jack had put a surprise Christmas gift in his mother's bag. She said he had bought her a tool set from the local hardware store. Or so she thought. After the interview, police called the local hardware store, who said they hadn't sold any kind of toolkit like the one that Gloria had described. Jack was looking more and more like a suspect, and on November 12th, the couple was asked to come down to the station again. Gloria informed the investigators that they were actually really busy that day, and asked if they could come the next day, November 13th, which detectives said was fine. So on the morning of November 13th, after church, Gloria and Jack headed down to the station, thinking they were going to identify Daisy's luggage. There was hardly anything left of Daisy's suitcase besides a few pieces of leather, but the young couple told investigators that it looked like part of her suitcase. As they were getting up to leave, officers asked Jack to hang back for a few more questions. Gloria then went home, as she had to take care of the kids. In the interview room, Jack was confronted with the discrepancies in his story. Why didn't he tell them about the Christmas present? And why did the store not remember selling it to him? Jack confirmed this Christmas present, but said that he had bought it from a person selling tools in a garage. It wasn't from a store. He then denied having anything to do with the explosion. They asked him why he thought he might have thrown up in the airport after his mother's plane had taken off. He told detectives that he was actually just so excited for his mom to be going on vacation that he got physically ill. And I actually started laughing when I read this. Like, you got so excited about someone else's trip that you physically vomited. I don't think that happens. Again, in this interview, Jack was very cocky. He offered to take a polygraph and told detectives they could search his property without a warrant, an offer they gladly took. Immediately, police went to go search the house. In the garage, they found some of Graham's old working clothes. In the pocket was a roll of copper wire. It appeared to be the same wire used in the detonating cap. It was bagged as evidence, and detectives continued on into the house. Then, in the couple's bedroom, hidden in their cedar dresser, was a copy of the life insurance policy in Jack's name, the one that had totaled $37,500. Jack had lied. He had told them that he had taken out a very small life insurance policy, and then he had lost a copy of it. But this was the maximum policy you could take out. So now, with Daisy's dying, not only was Jack getting her $150,000 estate, he would also get this $37,500 life insurance policy. All of this would equal almost $2 million nowadays, and that is a huge amount of money to get from someone's death. It was now getting late. Gloria started to put the kids to bed, but the FBI informed her that Jack would have to come down to the station to answer a few more questions about what they had just found. It was 11:06 p.m. when the detectives and Jack came back into the interrogation room. At the station, Agent Roy Moore wasted little time. "Jack," he said, "you blew up that plane to kill your mother, didn't you?" For the next hour, Jack played back and forth with detectives. "You did it." "No, I didn't." "Yes, you did." But then, at 12:05 a.m., on November 14th, Jack asked investigators for a glass of water. When they handed it to him, he said, "Okay, where do you want me to start?" Jack then told the investigators all about how he hated his mother. He described how he made the bomb, how he packed it in her bag. He admitted that the Medicine Bow Mountain crash had got him thinking and had given him the idea. Jack had been planning this for weeks and had bought the dynamite, timer, and wire back in mid-October. Because back then, you could buy dynamite over the counter. FBI would later confirm with various shop owners that Jack was the man who had bought the dynamite from them. Jack then wrote a 5-page confession letter, which he signed at the bottom. He was arrested and charged with sabotage. But then investigators realized something. There was no law against blowing up a plane. I know this sounds ridiculous, but without this law, they couldn't charge him for mass murder. All they could do was charge him with sabotage of a plane, which was a maximum of 10 years. So they decided that instead of trying to charge him on all 44 counts, they would just charge him with the murder of his mother. And on November 17th, 1955, he was charged with first-degree murder. Still, though, it's kind of stupid that he was never charged with the other 43 deaths. After his arrest, people in town couldn't stop talking about it. Most said that they weren't surprised by what Jack had done, as they'd always been a bit scared of him. His half-sister Helen said that Jack had always been violent, and that lately she didn't even like hanging around with him. A woman who had previously worked at the diner with Jack said that he was kind of like a Jekyll and Hyde. He could switch personalities in seconds. Quote, "He could be just as nice one moment and then bite your head off the next," end quote. His other former co-workers say that he was known to fly off the handle on the smallest little mistakes. He had a bad temper and used foul language. However, there were a few people who were genuinely surprised. A gas station attendant in town said that Jack would always come in and buy ice creams for the kids in town. But nobody was more surprised than Jack's wife, Gloria. She rejected the idea that Jack could have done this. Quote, "He was so good to his mother. They occasionally argued over the operation of their restaurant, but what business partnership doesn't have differences like that?" End quote. When Gloria was finally allowed to visit her husband, days after he was arrested, she asked Jack why he had signed the confession, but he refused to answer. Later, though, when interrogated by the media, Jack said that he had never confessed and that he was innocent. On December 9th, he was arraigned and, at the advice of his attorneys, pled innocent by reason of insanity. While Jack maintained his innocence, his wife supported him. Quote, "I'll believe he is innocent until he was proven guilty." She said she would remain loyal to her husband, as every wife should. Quote, "The newspapers have made my husband look like a mad dog wandering the streets. But he's been very good to me and has been a good father to the children," end quote. But I don't think you have to support your husband if you find out he's a mass murderer. But I understand Gloria was probably just still processing everything. On February 10th, 1955, Jack attempted suicide in his cell by hanging, but was found in time to be saved. He was then sent to a psychiatric ward to be evaluated. There, while being interviewed by a psychiatrist, he admitted again to bombing the plane. When asked if he understood that he also killed 43 other innocent people, Jack said that the other passengers, quote, "made little difference. It could have been 1,000. When their time comes, there is nothing they can do about it," end quote. He admitted that in October 1955, a month before the explosion, he had gotten a job at an electrical repair shop. He only worked there for about a week, but during those 7 days, he taught himself how to wire a timing device. The owner of the electrical shop would later be a key witness at trial. On February 24th, the insanity plea was dropped, and it was determined that Jack was sane and fit to stand trial. His trial began on April 16th, 1956. Jack decided to plead not guilty, despite the evidence against him and his earlier confessions. The trial was the first in American history to allow TV cameras in the court, and that was huge, Quote, it was the O.J. Simpson trial of its day, end quote, says Andrew J. Field, author of Mainline Denver, The Bombing of Flight 629. Hundreds of people lined up outside the courtrooms in hopes to get a seat at the trial. At trial, the prosecution had an overwhelming amount of evidence. Witnesses, physical evidence, and of course his own prior confession. The defense only presented their case for 2 hours because they really had nothing to go on. On Friday, May 4th, 1956, the jury of 7 men and 5 women were sent to deliberate. After only 70 minutes, they determined that Jack Gilbert Graham was guilty of first-degree murder and suggested the death penalty. Upon hearing the verdict, Gloria broke down in tears. Jack, on the other hand, appeared unconcerned and casual. His attorneys later tried to appeal his conviction, but Jack said he didn't want any part of an appeal. Quote, I accept the verdict of the jury and desire that it be carried out with convenient speed, end quote. He also said that he believed his trial was fair. By June 1956, Gloria had revoked her support of her husband. She told the Denver Post that after hearing all the things in trial that Jack had lied to her about, she realized he was guilty and agrees he should be put to death. But she also said that she felt bad for him because he was clearly mentally ill. After his conviction, a local reverend went to visit Jack. He had married Jack and Gloria and wanted to be Jack's spiritual advisor. When he asked Jack if it was true, if he'd really blown up the plane, Jack replied, quote, I guess it is, end quote. On July 14, 1956, President Dwight Eisenhower signed a law that prohibited the bombing of commercial airlines. Jack's execution date was set for January 11, 1957. On his last night, Jack ordered a beef steak, potatoes, salad, a fruit cocktail, and ice cream. He ate the ice cream and then gave the rest to his fellow prisoners. On the evening of Friday, January 11th, Jack Gilbert Graham was stripped down to his underwear and was led into the gas chamber at Colorado State Prison. Prior to his execution, he stated that, quote, as far as feeling remorse for those people, I don't. I can't help it. Everybody pays their way and takes their chances. That's just the way it goes, end quote. His wife Gloria did not attend his execution. She said her goodbyes to him a few days earlier. A mask was put over his eyes as he was strapped down to the chair. His official last words were a thank you to the warden. Later, the same warden recalled that Jack had gone to the death chamber, quote, as calmly as anyone I've seen, end quote. As the gas was released, he was said to have gasped for air and attempted to scream. His heart stopped beating at 8:06 p.m., and he was officially declared dead at 8:08 p.m. He was 24 years old. Ironically, it said that the gas took 11 minutes to kill him, the same number of minutes that the flight was in the air before the bomb detonated. His body was cremated and his ashes were buried in an unmarked grave in Denver Fairmount Cemetery. Gloria was one of the few people that attended a memorial service. After Jack's execution, Gloria changed her name back to her maiden name. She later remarried and divorced. Jack and Gloria's son Alan went on to be a college football star, and he married a woman named Denise in 1976. Unfortunately, 5 years after they married, Alan and Denise vanished. Their car was found abandoned in Oregon, and they haven't been seen or heard from since. Foul play is highly suspected, and the missing couple were officially declared dead in 1985. Gloria passed away young too, in her late 50s in 1992. Jack and Gloria's daughter Suzanne is now in her 60s, and the latest information on her is that she was a nurse in California. 65 years ago, 44 people lost their lives because of one man's grudge against his mother. The field where the plane crashed is still there, used as farmland. On the 60-year anniversary, there was talk about setting up a memorial for the 44 victims to mark the crash site, but I don't think anything has been done about that. I'm going to post a link to a virtual cemetery where you can see all the pictures of the 44 victims. And as always, I'll post more pictures on my social media pages, and the links are in my bio. Again, thanks so much for listening to another episode of Always Time for True Crime. You'll hear from me again next week. See you guys, and have an awesome one.